Good morning. Welcome to Campus Worship. I'm Kirsten Beachy. I chair EMU's Intellectual Life Committee, which is responsible for the Common Read, which is why I'm really excited to, after we sing together, have a chance to hear Faculty 10 talks inspired by the theme of callings. And I'm curious how many of you might have encountered this book already this semester, or might be teaching it in a class. Let me see a few. Okay. Callings, the Purpose and Passion of Work, is a collection of the stories of people and their work that were shared through the StoryCorps project. And for further introduction, we'll see two video clips about the book. First, we'll hear from StoryCorps founder Dave Isay speaking about the collection. And then secondly, we'll see a short animation of one of the stories in this collection. It's a conversation between sanitation workers Angelo Bruno and Eddie Nieves in their own voices.
This is who we can be. It's about the beauty and the poetry and the grace that can be found in the stories all around us when we take the time to listen. Callings is our latest book. I'm really proud of it. It's 53 stories about work from the hundreds of thousands that we've reported over the past 13 years. It kind of answers that question in 53 ways from 53 everyday people, from that Mary Oliver poem, that famous line from the Mary Oliver poem, "Tell me what is it that you're going to do with your one wild and precious life." It's a love letter to people whose jobs and whose work lives aren't celebrated enough in this country. There are a lot of teachers, social workers, nurses, and it's a way to say thank you. Kind of a radical book. There are no millionaires. There are no billionaires. There are no tech entrepreneurs. No politicians. 53 people who have found meaning in their work, who can teach us all so much about finding rich and fulfilling work lives.
Everybody would just come out just to talk to you.
People would say, "Oh, good morning, Angelo. Good morning, Eddie. You want a cup of coffee? You want lunch?"
And the nuns kissing us, too. We had nuns on the round. You know, I never had that before.
The younger guys would ask me, "How did you get that?" It's just a little good morning. Have a nice weekend. "Hey, you look great today. I could do 14 tons of garbage. I can't lift a baby carriage off of stuff and carry it down or hold someone's baby when they went to get their car."
The garbage ain't going nowhere. You know, the garbage will be there a half hour from now, an hour. So when you get it, you get it.
He made a statement one day that he does all the work and I do all the talking.
It came out wrong.
Look how he's getting at us. It just came out wrong.
I deserve it.
When I first came on the job, there was one old timer, I remember Gordy Flo, his name was. One day he stopped the truck. He tells me, "Angelo, you look down this block first. See all the sidewalks are all crowded up with garbage?" So I think nothing of it. My father always told me to respect my elders. I get to the end of the block. And he stops me again. "Get out of the truck. Look back. Nice and clean, right? People go walk on a sidewalk. Guys can make deliveries. Be proud of yourself."
The day that people learned that you were going to retire, we went maybe a block or two blocks, and six people came up to him saying, "You're crazy. What are we going to do when you leave?"
I'm a little bit of a marshmallow anyway, but I never thought my last day would be so emotional for me.
He's crying, they're crying, I'm crying, watching them cry. I've been very lucky because it's the best part I ever had. We used to try to take the same vacation and try to have the same day off. And I miss my partner.
I feel the same way, Eddie. I'll be honest with you. I miss it terribly. I'm like that little kid looking out the window now when I hit a truck. I think I could have done another 31 years.
me to number 389 in your blue hymnal.
Turn to number 304 and please stand.
Thank you.
Our three faculty speakers will come up while I introduce them. James Richardson will speak first. He's assistant professor and chair of the music department. And three things about James. His first job was seating tables and washing dishes at the Village Inn, just up off Route 11, maybe that way. His worst job was at a door-making factory in Stanley, Virginia. He lasted one day on the assembly line. And if he were not a professor at EMU, he would be singing and teaching somewhere. In fact, when he taught music at a high school and they had a dress up as your favorite profession day, he just dressed like he dressed every day. Dr. Carol Hurst is associate professor and program director for social work. As a child, though, she wanted to be a park ranger. Her first job was thinning apples in an orchard. And if she were not a professor at EMU or a clinical social work therapist, she would be a tour guide at Monticello so she could talk to more people about history. And last but not least, Dr. Matthew Siderhurst, professor of chemistry, as a child wanted to be a pilot delivering aid supplies. His first job, a lifeguard, and his worst job, temping as a typist because he never actually got to work.
So I'm a singer, and I teach singing, and unlike a lot of folks who wrestle with that age-old question, what do I want to do when I grow up, as long as I can remember, I wanted to sing, much to the chagrin of, I can remember down the hill at EMHS, a person who shall remain nameless was trying to help me register for classes and finally said, James, you're being a pain in the ass. And that's because all I wanted to do was register for music courses. And then there's that, you know, constant question nagging at me throughout my whole life. How on earth is singing practical? You're going to starve. And it's a good thing that I don't still think about my vocation that way, as I would feel guilty and full of shame because I'm teaching generations of people to go be starving artists. But nonetheless, even as thoroughly fulfilled as I am as a music teacher, it's a question that we constantly have to answer. There's kind of a stigma that is associated with my calling, with my vocation. And it's as though callings could be ranked. For instance, just a moment. Here we go. But you see, my calling didn't seem as noble as, say, perhaps a doctor or a lawyer, and maybe that's for financial reasons, and I'm sorry for doctors and lawyers because you're always picked on. But furthermore, having grown up in a Christian home, I very much wanted to serve God with my profession and wrestled with where is the merit, the value, the worth in entertaining others with my talent. And I don't mean to suggest that music is only about entertainment, but it does seem pretty self-indulgent. And here's the other way that I, on a kind of subconscious level, felt like callings are ranked from legitimate to less legitimate. Sacred spheres, it would seem, are always better than secular spheres. After all, when I was growing up in the 80s, I can remember going to the Christian bookstore, to the music section, to get my album, and there'd be a poster there that would say, if you love Madonna, you're really going to love such and such, Amy Grant. Or if you love the sounds of Billy Joel, you're really going to like. And somehow, that was supposed to be better, but it always, no offense to Amy Grant, always felt a little aesthetically inferior to the thing that we were trying to copy. So, sacred was supposed to be better. So nonetheless, on a certain level, I believed if I were to pursue a career in music, it would have to be music ministry, like leading music and worship. Well, then there's a real integrity in not making a lot of money and starving, and after all, you're doing it all for God's glory. All right, great. Before I was born, my parents bought a large print of a 17th century landscape painting that I consequently grew up with. It hung over the sofa in every living room of every house that I've ever lived in. It still hangs above the sofa in my mother's house. And throughout the 1600s and the 1700s, and arguably some of the 1800s, the French artist Claude Lorrain was regarded as the prince of landscape painters. I don't know how well you can see it. Kind of hazy. The painting itself is a little hazy. But here we've this bucolic, pastoral scene. It depicts a shepherd there. He's playing his pipe. Next to him is a woman washing laundry, and there's a woman collecting water from a spring. There's this herd of cattle, goats, and oxen that are heading to this rolling river, and it all paints this very harmonious, beautiful landscape. Everything seems right with the world. And it's a landscape painting. Artists or art historians will often talk about Lorrain's use of light. You can see dawn breaking just over the left of the painting. And you can even start to depict the species of trees. This was innovative for its time. But despite it all, Lorrain felt this pressure that a lot of landscape artists felt, and that was to legitimize his art. And he did it by painting in the very corner, and you probably can't even see. Yeah, you can't see here. But in that corner, there's the Holy Family. Baby Jesus, Joseph, Mary, and they're being protected by an angel. And then he names the painting Flight from Egypt. And the idea, yeah, it's a landscape painting, right? So this way he could sell it to the Pope, which he did. And he also, smart businessman, very savvy, and also was able to sell his paintings to cardinals. But at its heart, this is a landscape painting. My driving is either good or bad. It's bad, by the way. It doesn't matter if I put a Christian bumper sticker on the back of my car, and I don't, because if I had an ichthys, if I had a fish, it would not speak well for the gospel. I'd be cutting you off, and you'd be going, oh, those Christians, right? So if you were to ask my why, what is my ultimate end beyond just my calling, I would answer in the spirit of 1 Corinthians 10:31 and the hymns that we were singing. I'll tell you, it's to glorify God in everything I do. Ironically, I think that the church often understands that by thinking in terms of sacred and secular realms. So when I was an undergraduate music student, I had an epiphany when I started studying my hero composer of the 17th and 18th century, Johann Sebastian Bach, and that is that he did not see these distinctions. Instead, he viewed every part of his life as worship. At the end of many of his scores, he wrote the inscription, Soli Deo Gloria, to God alone be the glory. It didn't matter if it was a selection for Sunday morning worship or if it was for a party by the prince. He saw every sphere. Everything was worship. Everything about his life was for God's glory. There's a quotation that's been misattributed to the theologian, the reformer Martin Luther. I like it nonetheless. So it reads, "The maid who sweeps her kitchen is doing the will of God just as much as the monk who prays, not because she may sing a Christian hymn as she sweeps, but because God loves clean floors. The Christian shoemaker does his Christian duty not by putting little crosses on the shoes, which they used to do, but by making good shoes because God is interested in good craftsmanship. So how can I glorify God when singing opera or musical theater, something that might seem trite? Because, I hope, God admires beauty. It's one of the things that points to a creator and our being made in his image, and I think it's going to be one of the themes addressed by N.T. Wright next week when he comes and speaks here. Scottish Olympic medalist and runner Eric Little, wrestled with this same dichotomy, which is retold in that classic 80s film, Chariots of Fire. His sister Jenny begged him, and there's this beautiful scene when they're outside of Edinburgh, Scotland, and at Sir Arthur's Seat, if you ever get to go there, and they're having this kind of heated debate. Jenny's begging him to join her on the mission field in China, believing that his running was just a frivolity that got in the way of his higher calling. And he did indeed become a missionary, but that came after his pursuit of running. In the film, he argues with his sister, Jenny, and you need to do this with a Scottish accent, which I won't attempt, but Jenny, I believe God made me for a purpose, China, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. To give it up would be to hold him in contempt. And he goes on, it's not just fun. To win is to honor him. I sing and I teach singing because that's what God made me to do. And when I do that, I feel his pleasure. And in the words of a translated Bach aria or song, at sea, at home, on land, abroad, I smoke my pipe to the glory of God. And I do like a good pipe of tobacco.
When I was a little girl, my mother Pearl used to tell me many Bible stories. She was my first teacher regarding sacred things. And that's what I think being called is. It's answering to what is sacred in your life and responding and being moved and strengthened to keep on responding. So as I was thinking about what to tell you about my own calling, I had to remember my mother telling me the Old Testament story of Samuel. I remember being cuddled up next to my mother as she told me about another child named Samuel who lived long before me. And he was very precious to his mother, Hannah, because she had for many years suffered being barren in a culture where women's worth was often associated with mothering. And she was being made fun of by her co-wife, who did have children. In 1 Samuel, it tells the story of Hannah going with her husband and the extended clan to a place called Shiloh to do the sacrifices and the holy ritual of their time. And Hannah was actually weeping about her infertility to God. And the priest Eli, he noticed Hannah's lips moving, but not uttering sound. And what Eli suspected was that Hannah was actually under the influence of something, that she was intoxicated because of her odd behavior. But Hannah wasn't drunk. She was actually grieving and crying out to God in her heart to allow her to have a child. Ultimately, the scripture tells us that God did answer her prayer, and the previously infertile Hannah conceived a son, and she determined that she must give her beloved child that she so much wanted, to give him back to God so that he would serve God. And so after she weaned Samuel from breastfeeding, she took him back to Shiloh, and she gave him to that priest Eli so that he could serve God in that place. So now we get to think about Samuel growing up there in Shiloh. One night, the child Samuel was lying sleeping. It was his job to personally assist Eli at this point, who had grown old and was blind. And Samuel wakes up in the night because he hears his name being called. Samuel, Samuel. And he thinks that Eli is calling him. So he gets up and he goes to Samuel to see what he needs. And Eli says, he goes to Eli. And Eli says, "No, I didn't call you. Go back to bed." So Samuel does. He lies down and he tries to drift off to sleep. And again, he hears it. His name, Samuel, Samuel. So he hops up again and he goes back to Eli and he says, "You called me. I heard you." And Eli insists, "No, I did not. You can go back to bed." And so Samuel does. But it happens again. And this third time, Samuel comes to ask him why he is calling him. And Eli realizes that something is happening to Samuel, that Samuel is responding to something bigger and beyond their relationship. And so he tells Samuel, "It really isn't me calling your name, so it must be the Lord calling your name. So go back to bed, but this time if you hear your name being called again, this time say, 'Yes, Lord, speak to me. I am listening to what you have to say.'" So Samuel, he goes back to bed, and it does indeed happen again. And he is given a vision from God that it is him that is supposed to be a prophet in Shiloh, and that Eli's own two sons, who have the birthright of this position, will die. And Eli's lineage will come to an end. And this vision isn't a very nice thing for Eli. So actually, when Eli, who is something of a mentor to the boy, asks him to tell him if he actually heard from God, you can imagine that for Samuel, it would have been a very difficult conversation to have. To tell Eli that he had this vision of his family's end and that Samuel is there to take over. But actually, Samuel does end up telling Eli the full story. And scripture tells us that Eli ends up accepting that, and Samuel lives his life as a prophet doing the will of God. And he was called as a boy. I like this story of Samuel, and to be inclusive, we might say, I like the calling of Samuel, but to be inclusive, I also like the calling of his mother, Hannah, because she called out to God about her deepest desire. So both of these stories for me relate to being called, and that calling is both very important and also elusive. Wouldn't we all like to have God calling our name in the night and telling us what we are meant to do? How many of you would like that? Have doubts about your major? Want to know what job is waiting for you out there that you're being prepared for? That would be nice, wouldn't it? To hear your name being called and receive this holy vision of your future? Well, I'm here to tell you that maybe the stuff that you worry and fret about that keeps you from falling asleep, maybe you need to listen through that stuff. Maybe there's a message, a yearning, a leading to go do something, to serve somehow. And one step leads to the next step, and all of a sudden, when you look back, you will see that you were led, and that a door opened here, and you had an experience, and a window opens over there, and allows you to see that something is important, so you respond, and it just keeps building until you're able to walk through one door, and then open the next door, and the next door, that you are meant to walk through. I would tell you that is how it happened for me. When I was an undergraduate student at this school, I studied what was interesting to me. I was a sociology major, actually. And sometimes I felt like I should have studied something else that had a clearer career path, like nursing or education, so that I would know exactly what I was going to be doing after I had studied. I actually had some panic as a senior. What am I going to do with this? But I ended up taking a step, and I went to a place that I had a connection to. I went out to Denver, Colorado, where I had a good friend, and I found a job working in an agency that served transient newcomers to the city, folks who would arrive and run out of money and be unable to take the next step without some help. One day, a couple came in, and they were in crisis. And they were arguing about why they had come together without resources to this big city. I had a love seat in my office, and they came in and sat down side by side on that love seat and looked at me. And then almost at the very same time, first thing they said was, "We're divorced." I remember that moment as a moment of call in my own life, because I could see that they were locked in a negative intimacy, but were very much attached. And there they were on my love seat. What I thought also at the moment was, you know, I didn't say this out loud, but it was going on in my head, "I don't get this, but it's interesting, and I think I need to go back to graduate school." I ended up enrolling in social work graduate school within the next year, and even after I became a social worker, even after I got my license as a social worker and was practicing doing psychotherapy with many families in a mental health context, I had doubts. I had times when my path for my next step wasn't clear. I had a time when I followed another calling to help as a birth attendant in home birth situations. I even started nursing classes listening to that call. And I attended multiple home births and learned much about a radical form of being with women called midwifery. Accompanying women in birth is to help them to believe that they are strong enough to do this very hard thing. And that path became a part of me too. And being a midwife is still my very best metaphor for what I do as a clinical social worker providing psychotherapy. I am strength-based. I see where people are strong, and I sit with them while they recognize this strength, while something is being born inside them. Even when they are going through very hard things. Ernest Hemingway says in his book, A Farewell to Arms, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong in the broken places." I see God speaking directly to each of us through the circumstances of our lives. Sometimes it is elusive, but our steps make it clearer. When we go forward towards things, even hard things, when we are brave like Hannah was in her barren grief, or like Samuel was in speaking up and having a difficult conversation with a mentor about what we really see, what we really hear and know, it is a moment of being formed and finding personal strength. So even at those times when we think maybe we've been forsaken, that our wants and our desires are not coming true, remember to listen. Listen in those hard times, for it may be then that you are being formed for a God-given task that you haven't even dreamed about yet.
So I'm interested in the connections that we had there. So my middle name is Samuel, and so that was like, ah. And now I've, well, thank you very much. I also have like dun 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 dun, like going through my head. You guys know?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. At least there are a few people that have seen that movie, 80s movie. Yay! All right. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of the story of how I got to be a professor here at EMU. I think that stories are very powerful and they're very important, but you also have to distrust the teller a little bit, especially when it's something that is as important as it is to, like, this is my story of how I got here, right? So I know that the story that I'm going to tell you is probably a little cleaner than what it actually was at the time. Like, it was a lot probably messier than what I'm going to tell you. The other thing about what I'm going to say is part of it's got story of failure in it. And I think that failure is a particularly powerful thing. But that's probably, one of these things that you have to question me a little bit more about how am I telling the story of failure. So there are kind of three things that I want you to take from this. And I think about, like, how I got to where I am. And trying to figure out, what is my calling? Where am I supposed to be? So I think one of those things, if I had somebody talking to me, I would want them to say, well, what are you good at, right? Can you pay attention to that? Two, do you know what your issues are? And I'm not saying that you have to know your issues, because it's going to be pretty obvious from my story that I did not know my issues until I got down the track, and then I was like, oh, okay, I can see maybe, right? So that's one of them. And then the other one was to be open to failure. And then I realized as I worked with this more, I'm not good at being open to failure. Maybe it should be more like the importance of failure, right? So what you're good at, being open to failure, and being aware of your issues, right? So those are points that I want to, I realize I look at the clock, I gotta keep this moving. So let me take you back. I'm gonna jump around in time a little bit. So I grew up all over the place. My family did a couple of terms with Mennonite Central Committee, which is a church organization. We worked for one of the mission organizations as well. My folks have plunked themselves down in Australia and have been there. Both my brother and sister, I see my sister back there, right? They're dual citizens. I'm the only one that's not. I didn't get there. So I grew up with this idea about, I want to save the world. And so we had this story about, like, what did I want to be as a kid? I wanted to be a pilot. Not only did I want to be a pilot, right, but I wanted to fly a C-130 Hercules. Anybody, any kids out there, they're like, okay, I see a couple of, this is a really big airplane. This is like, I want to go save, and it was generally like people in Africa or Southeast Asia, or it was always like out there somewhere. And like, I was gonna do this big. A C-130 is a big plane. So like, this is heroic, right? I'm gonna save the world and I'm gonna do it big, right? So that was the one thing that I had in my head. The other thing then is that I was good at sciences, right? So this means I went to Goshen College. So I actually come to like the dark side of the force to teach here. I went to that other school and I got there and I want to save the world, right? And I'm good at sciences, right? So what did I want to be?
Doctor,
yeah, right. Yeah, that's all right. So this is another commonality here, right? So, you're a good Mennonite kid. You want to save the world. You're good at sciences, right? I'm going to be a doctor. I got there. I was a biology major. I really enjoyed biology. And then, once again, the dark side, I had a chemistry professor that, like, pulled me into research. And I started doing chemistry. I was like, oh, I really like this, right? So I enjoyed that. And he said, you know what? You should think about teaching at some point. And I was like, teaching? I'm not going to be a teacher. One of the things that particularly got his goat is that I had these notebooks that I had slaved over. I brought them. I don't have a picture, but I've got show and tell, right? So these are chemistry notebooks. So for any of you that are biology or chemistry majors, you know how you slave over those, right? So I slaved over these, and what happened at Goshen was there was always this thing about if you were a good student, then the next generation would want your notebooks. So I gave my notebooks to other people, and I gave them away. My professor was like, don't do that. You're going to teach someday. You're going to want those. And I'm like, not going to teach, right? I didn't think that that's where I was headed. And I think I really fell into that whole thing about, those who can't do, teach, right? That's I'm not going to be a teacher. That's not the direction that I'm going. So This actually started to turn around a little bit for me when I went to a conference of, I think it's called MMA, it's the Mennonite Medical Association or something like that, it's doctors and nurses. And there was a guy there who talked about if you really want to help improve people's health, you should not be a doctor. And I was like, whoa, what's that all about? And he's like, you should go do economics. You should do community development. You should do business. And as you help people to improve their own situation, they're actually, that's the thing that improves health. And I was like, think about that. I also had a class that was about community development. We read a book, I think it was called It Comes from the People. And it was all about people improving their own situations and not necessarily having white Westerners ta-da, fly planes and drop supplies on their heads, which is what I thought I was going to do, right? So I started thinking about this and trying to figure out, where am I going, right? So I've got this inkling there. So I went, I got married. I was a good Mennonite, right? I got married when I graduated from Goshen, moved out to Colorado. Colorado has also appeared a couple of times here this morning. And when we got out there, I studied for the MCAT. So this is the test that you take before you go to medical school. And I really enjoyed the chemistry that I was studying there. My wife said, you should pay attention to the fact that you would like this. I'm like, no, I'm going to medical school, right? And so I got good scores on the MCAT. I applied to one school out there because I was kind of following my wife around. And when you find out about getting into medical school, there are two kinds of envelopes that you can get, right? You can get a big envelope, and if you get the big envelope, it's got all the important information about how you're going to go to the school, right? And you can get the little envelope, and the little envelope is not the one that you want, right? So which envelope do you think I got? I got the little envelope. No, I wish I could tell this story is like yeah, I got the big envelope, and I realized that, the thing that I should be doing is no, right? So I got the little envelope. And oh my goodness, that's tough. That's tough to get. And it was interesting, at that time, I started thinking about, what am I going to do next? What am I doing? I was working for a physical therapist at that time, trying to get some more clinical experience. And after not getting into medical school the first time around, there are a lot of people that don't get in the first time around. They try and they stick to it. I gave it up after one try. Part of it was I was working for a physical therapist and I realized, I don't like patient care, right? maybe something you shouldn't be doing this if you're like so. And then I'm like, why is it that I am so stuck on doing this thing? Now I got to take you back a little ways. I want to go back to my childhood. And one of the things that I'm an oldest brother, so it's my sister back there. She's the youngest. I have a brother. Some of you may know my brother. He's bigger, Micah Hurst, right? So he's bigger than I am. And he was not bigger than I was initially. And I used to pick on him mercilessly when we were little, right? And when I was still bigger. I quit once he got bigger than I was. So I would generally, verbal, right? And then eventually he would like hit me. And then I'd, Mom, Micah did, right? And my mom always had this thing that she would say. She would say, why do you pick on your brother? Do you not feel, good about yourself? And I was always like, I do feel good about myself, Mom. And, no, right? I wasn't listening. I realized I don't feel good about myself, right? And so part of wanting to go to medical school was this thing about, like, that's the thing that you do, right? If you want to really be recognized, in our society, being in medical school, being a doctor, that's the thing that you want. And this was this thing that was really getting in my way to think about, what am I really good at? What do I really enjoy? I love chemistry, right? I found out that I liked insects as well. This is courtesy of my wife as well. She got me into spiders, and I found out insects, and blah, 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 blah. Anyways, winding story. Talk to me about that later. So I didn't get into medical school. I thought a little bit more about my issues. I thought about, what kind of things would I enjoy doing. So I quit doing physical therapy, which is probably good. And I went and I drove a bus. And so, woohoo! So this is like, what would I going to enjoy? So I drove transit buses in Denver, which isn't quite the C-130 Hercules that I wanted to. Like, I wanted something that was bigger. But, big bus works as well. I did that. I say I have like the path of least resistance to a PhD. I followed my wife around, and she was doing stuff in graduate school, and like, hey, yay, I did stuff in graduate school, and I followed, you know, the things that were kind of in front of me, but also the things that I enjoyed. So I ended up going through graduate school. I ended up getting a doing a postdoc. This is one of the dirty little secrets that we don't tell you. Maybe I shouldn't tell you, right? That you go, you graduate from here. What do you, what can you do? I can go to graduate school after that. When I get my graduate degree, what can I do? Oh, I can go work for somebody else. So I worked for somebody else for a while as a postdoc. Finally, I landed a real job here at EMU, right? Very winding. What I want to say to you from that is these ideas about right failure can be something that is really important. Makes us focus, and I wish that I was more open to it. Right, but it was very important for me. Following the things that you like, that is saying something to you. Pay attention and mind your issues if you can. I realize that's hard. But what are the drivers that are on you that might be pointing you in the wrong direction? I think we're running out of time. I will stop.
So give us just a few minutes. So appreciating very much opening up into vocation and callings, exploring, discerning, discovering. There's a group of people here on campus today for Camp Recruiting Day who have followed their callings into outdoor ministry in Christian and other kinds of camps and retreat centers. If you can see the list of who all's here, and if you want to have lunch with some of these people, and we welcome that in the East Dining Room. They're also available in the Campus Center. Come on up, Liz. I want to feature a couple things happening tomorrow. And that's Daoud Nassar from Tent of Nations is here tomorrow in the morning at 11 at Martin Chapel in Seminary Chapel. He's speaking, and also in the West Dining Room over lunch. You can see some of these events. It's kind of small, but you can see it. And then in the evening, there's a lecture. People who go on the Middle East cross-culturals almost always visit Tent of Nations. How many of you have been there or met Nassar? Several people have. This is amazing that we have the chance to host him and engage with him on campus tomorrow. Liz also has an announcement.
Yes, you can click on the Measure for Measure, 7:30, so tomorrow, and Wednesday. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So yes, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday. Measure for Measure is happening in the Lee Eshelman Studio Theater. If you heard about, you probably have heard about it on campus. If you haven't, then there's definitely a rock somewhere. Also, I've been chalking campus, so my hands are all chalky, and so I'm going to be getting the rest of chalk everywhere. So you should definitely come see it and support your fellow theater students. And also, there's a lot of new students who are not theater students that are involved, and it's really cool to see different things. And I was hearing about failure as well. There are some parts of attempts to succeed within this play and different failures that actually work out in the end when they're revealed. So that's all I'll say. But if you do come to see it, you should read the synopsis and the program so it can help you out, because it is Shakespeare, but I do feel that it's very visually pleasing. Pleasing? Yeah.
And Becca, are you doing this one? I should have had you come up earlier so you were ready. This last slide is from YServe, and when Becca's finished, then you're free to go.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Becca. I'm a co-president of YServe, and as you see on the screen, we have some scholarship money to go to Urbana in Illinois to their conference on Discern, which I think is interesting given our talk today. There are rides available if you'd like to go. It is over, I believe it's over Christmas break, and the price goes up on November 15th. So if you have questions or if you'd like to go, please email yserve@emu.edu. Yeah, thank you.